Welcome to the AI Hustle Podcast, the podcast where we break down the latest in AI news, tools, and interview experts helping you hustle and do more using AI. If you've been following the podcast for a while, you'll know that over the last 6 months, I've been working on a stealth AI startup. Of the hundreds of projects I've covered, this is the one that I believe has the greatest potential. So today I'm excited to announce AI Box. AI Box is a no-code AI app building platform paired with the App Store for AI that lets you monetize your AI tools. The platform lets you build apps by linking together AI models like ChatGPT, Midjourney, and 11 Labs. Eventually, we'll integrate with software like Gmail, Trello, and Salesforce, so you can use AI to automate every function in your organization. To get notified when we launch and be one of the first to build on the platform, you can join the waitlist at aibox.ai. The link is in the show notes. We are currently raising a seed round of funding. If you're an investor that is focused on disruptive tech, I'd love to tell you more about the platform. You can reach out to me at jaden@aibox.ai. I'll leave that email in the show notes. Welcome to the AI Chat Podcast. I'm your host, Jaden Schaefer. Today on the podcast, we have the pleasure of being joined by Connor Jensen, who is a technology, AI, and strategy executive who currently leads the field CDO team at Dataiku, a platform designed to build, deploy, and manage data and AI projects. With a really diverse background that spans from being a barista and archery instructor to an Air Force weather forecaster and insurance actuary, Connor brings a really unique perspective to the world of AI. So when he's not helping companies navigate their AI journeys, he enjoys spending time with his wife, seven children, and a small flock of ducks and a very fancy goose on the outskirts of Chicago. Welcome to the show, Connor. Did I sum that up right? Am I correct in your intro there?
It's a weird intro when I listened to it, but you hit the high points. Thank you, Jaden. Super excited to be here.
Awesome. Well, super happy to have you on the show. For those that don't know, I met Connor back at the AI4 conference earlier this year, was impressed by some of the things he was working on. Really solid guy and visionary in the AI space. So excited to pick your brain, get some of your insights. What I would be curious on from your perspective, kind of to kick this off, tell us a little bit about like your background and your journey, right? So obviously we got archery instructor, we got Air Force, we got all these different areas. What brought you, I guess, what was your interest there? But like what really brought you to technology? What brought you to AI?
Sure. So, to not go too deep into it, but I've sort of been, I like to switch fields. I like to learn and sort of continually be challenged, right? My sort of like meandering path through my background sort of clearly shows that. But I've always been a big fan of sort of math and analytics and applied side of things. So other than sort of my post-college dropout dirtbag years, which is, when I did a lot of the, weirder, more esoteric stuff, I joined the Air Force and I started as a meteorologist there, very much an applied science side of thing, right? Using models, using data, making forecasts, and, had enough of sort of a science-y and math bit that, that really sort of like captured me, right? Like we weren't the ones building the models. It's not like we were guys working at like, the research stations, things like that. But that sort of has shaped a lot of what I've done since then. I went back to school, actually got a degree in mathematics, ended up in insurance after, sort of spending some more time in the retail and Starbucks. So I kind of wandered around, but always with that idea of like, how are we going to use data? How are we going to make better decisions? And was lucky to be at an insurance company now almost 12 years ago. That was, I think, early on in saying, hey, how are we going to use data science and sort of this emerging field coming out of the tech industries to change how we do business. And insurance is a really interesting space to have done that because insurance has, a long, long history of using data to make decisions, right? Actuarial science, sort of like precursors of statistics, right? So in one regard, you could almost look at them as like one of the like OG data science fields. But
yep, I'd totally see that.
But it's also been doing things the same way for a long time. And it does that because they work, but it also then has, some reticence to move into new and different things. And so it was really cool to be at a place that had both a long history of using data, but then also enormous amounts of opportunity in changing how they can do that. And so I was obviously coming at it from working in the business, working as an actuary, more the analytics side, and really was lucky, didn't always feel that way at the time, as we were building an on-prem Hadoop cluster to do all this stuff. And realizing how hard the tech was, especially at a non-tech company, right? You're dealing with IT outsourced to contractors to do the work and everything. And like the tech side ended up being sort of like the biggest challenge. And so I kind of got put on that. Now, I won't say against my will, but sort of against where I would like to spend my time, which is with the business and working on the projects, but got stuck on the tech side. And really then that was a huge opportunity, you know, in retrospect, right? Like, honestly, the hardest problems are usually the ones where there's the most opportunity. And so spent, you know, a few years there helping to sort of build the team and the platform, went over to another company to do that, and then moved over to tech now about sort of 6-7 years ago, really to focus on working with sort of my former peers in the sort of like those non-core tech industries, especially, but, you know, any company that's really sort of changing, trying to change what they do to make data science, AI, whatever the sort of how we're describing at the moment, a stronger fabric of their business, right? Because if you don't start with data as that sort of core asset from the beginning, which most companies, you know, have been around long enough to not have done that,
right?
It's a big culture and strategy change, stuff like that. So that's sort of where I've now been lucky to focus and do across industries and companies of different maturity and stuff. And so it's been a weird journey to get here in some respects, but you know, it's a blast, so I can't complain.
That is awesome. And yeah, I mean, like, so much of life is about the journey, what brings us there, and the backgrounds we bring from all of that kind of bring us to what we're doing today. Talk to me about how you started working. You've been there for a number of years at Dataiku. Mm-hmm. Tell me about how you started working there, and maybe, I guess, for people that don't know, tell them a little bit about Dataiku and what problem they're currently solving for customers.
Sure. And so to talk sort of real quick about Dataiku, Dataiku is an analytics workbench, right? And so it is designed to be a single source for building data products, regardless of complexity. So sort of that from your most basic things, you know, just doing, you know, data pipelines to feed a BI dashboard or a report or something, all the way through to leveraging the latest and greatest technology of, you know, deep learning or generative AI or whatever we're talking about 2 years from now. You know, we're sort of that framework and that platform that allows you to bring all those different tools and have all your users' different capabilities work on it. So there are the sort of full code capabilities for engineers and data scientists and your more technical people, but also there are, you know, there's a GUI, there are ways for those non-technical users who know the data and know, you know, the business and the problems to also be able to work with it in sort of one platform. And then we sit sort of wherever you want to sit architecturally. We come from the Hadoop space. So that's actually where I met Dataiku, was now almost 7 years ago, doing a POC, looking at it when we were still managing an on-prem cluster. We obviously now have sort of, you know, on-prem in VPCs, a fully SaaS offering, right? So we cover all those different, you know, deployment capabilities for any industry. Again, we're sort of general purpose. And so that's that was a big part of the excitement for me when I had the opportunity to come over here, was, you know, I'd done this in the military and in the meteorology space and in retail working at Starbucks and then in insurance. And I'd sort of seen different domains walk through this journey of trying to be more data-driven and more AI-driven. And so I really wanted to sort of have that opportunity to go in somewhere where I could look across industries and see what's similar and what's different, right? And the thing that's really my hypothesis going in that so far is, you know, holding sort of true, is that there's a lot more similarities than there are differences. Like the use cases may be different from an industry to an industry. Like, so what a finance company wants to work on project-wise is going to be different than what a manufacturing company does, or et cetera. But the structural changes, the cultural changes, the sort of challenges in moving there, I see a lot more similarities across industries than I do see differences, which has been the fun part of sort of sitting on this side of the fence and being able to look across so many different companies at different stages of maturity from all different industries. That's what brought me here, and that's what's keeping me here on this tech side for now.
Very cool. Very cool. I would be curious, you know, based off of what you're currently seeing at Dataiku, so the problems you're solving, what are some predictions about changes you see in AI and perhaps AI in the enterprise over the next number of years? Where do you see, where do you see things going, changing? What are the big shifts you are forecasting?
So the biggest one for me probably really comes down to sort of who is doing this at enterprises, right? There's still, and for a long time, there was that sort of barrier to entry of working with, you know, large scale data, working with predictions of such, of having to have the programming skills to be able to work with it. Whether it was, you know, going back to sort of days of using SaaS, And, you know, things like, you know, like the various tools that IBM had created and things like that, where you had to go to the tool that did it, and it required some level of sort of coding or expertise, through to R and Python and whatever. And so, you know, for the last 10 years, anytime you hear somebody say, hey, I want to get into data science, what do I want to do? What do I have to do? And it's, you know, go learn R or go learn Python or go, you know, mm-hmm. learn some tool. And I think that's going to continue to sort of fade away. And, you know, for me, yeah, there are still problems where that actually you need to have that scale of the data or it's streaming or it's things like that, where you need to have those skill sets. But I think as we continue to lower the barrier to entry to working with larger sets of data, to working with more complex sort of algorithmic and analytical approaches, that knowledge of the data and that knowledge of the domain and the problems to solve continues to become more important. And we make it easier for those folks that are in the business making decisions today, or are, you know, across the, you know, across companies, how do you get them into this world of making these decisions without having to be a programmer themselves, right? And then I think that's the second part that really starts to change, is I think companies will start to change how they hire and how they train across, or I say, should say, the more successful companies will change how they hire and how they think about bringing people into the organization. You know, one of the questions I always love to ask a company when they're sort of talking about, well, we want to be more AI driven, right? What is that? What does that mean? How does that change, right? And, you know, it's not just hire a bunch of data scientists that are going to, you know, sit off onto the side making projects that, you know, they throw over the fence. And, you know, we've all sort of seen the challenges of getting things deployed and everything. But, you know, I'll ask him, it's like, okay, so what does that mean to you? How does that change? You know, when you talk about being more AI driven, are you going to go out and add to your interview process for hiring salespeople that they know how to work with data, that they use data to make their decisions, and that, you know, that's going to change how you go out to market and sell? Are you hiring HR people, you know, your people managers, with what is their viewpoint on, you know, leveraging data science tools, you know, things like, you know, like a churn prediction risk or employee, you know, flight risk, things like that, right? Like, and if the, you know, and the answer is, more often than not, especially when you're talking to sort of those business leaders, is like, oh no, that's weird. Why would I ask a salesperson how good they are working with data, right? But that's
right.
If you want a data-driven company, that is everybody. That's not just hiring a bunch of analysts who are building things in the corner. That's an essential component of it, to be fair, right? You need to have those people who can build it, but you can't just create it, right? This isn't the field of dreams. It's not you build it and they will come, right? Like, you need to be hiring people in every facet of your business who are looking to work with data, who are looking to work with analytics and AI products. That's how you have to change it. And I think that we'll start to see, I think there's still a sort of a fundamental gap in many companies and really understanding the need for changing, especially people, right? I think that's actually one of the hardest parts to change. You know, we think about the technology is hard, right? I don't want to pretend otherwise. You know, maintaining, especially the pace of change of the technology, you know, like, you know, that sort of today, like working with, you know, one of the three big hyperscaler vendors for your cloud platform is a given, and everybody sort of has their cloud strategy. But, you know, 10 years ago, I spent 6 months trying to get, you know, a company to go onto cloud, and it was a non-starter for, you know, for a year. And years ago, it started to become more accepted. Today, now it's sort of almost the default. I mean, it's entirely feasible that 10 years from now, nobody goes to any of the three clouds that sort of we go to today. Like, who the hell knows, right? Like,
true.
So yeah. So that pace of change of technology is really challenging. And I don't want to underscore that by any means. But like, people are way harder than technology in the end, right? And so if you look at a company that's got, you know, even a small company, right? A company of 1,000 people. And I, you know, not to sort of like air dirty, like, you know, like I look at sort of sometimes even within Dataiku, I'm like, hey, we preach this. You don't even always act that way in sort of like how our hiring decisions, things like that. And we're not not that big a company, and we're only 10 years old. So, you know, you look at a big, you know, manufacturer who's got 20,000 employees or 50,000 employees around the world and has been around for 100 or 200 years. Like, you have to change so much, and it's at every layer of the organization. And so that's that change that I think that we'll start to see more companies really start to think about the people side of this holistically across their companies. And then that will play into sort of those lowering those barriers to entry. And then the last thing that, you know, I'll just say is I think that the pace of change will really continue to just just be a ever accelerating challenge, right? You know, I think that that's one thing that we're continuing to have to sort of keep up from. And I'm really curious. I think that, you know, some of the biggest companies in the world will end up really being sort of crushed by this, the inability to keep pace with the change of the technology, especially when you look at, you know, and coming from, you know, a time in financial services has, you know, long been a more data-driven organization. You know, you go back to sort of who were the first adopters of IBM mainframes and decision-making stuff and algorithms. You know, financial services was certainly one of the biggest areas, and they're still now beholden to some of those tech decisions that they made 50, 60 years ago in some cases. And so, like, first mover advantage in some cases is actually like trapped companies with, you know, there's all the jokes around that, you know, the entire world global financial system was run on mainframes and Excel, and like it's a joke that's like kind of scarily true, having lived that side of the fence. And so
I believe it.
You know, I think that pan continues to get kicked by a lot of companies as, you know, say, oh, well, we want to move off of this, whatever this system that we have, you know, processing customer transactions or so, whatever that we bought 50 years ago. We've got all this crazy stuff tied into this, you know, mainframe. And every time you go, hey, we should change that, and, you know, you go, oh, well, it'll be $100 million maybe, right? Like the price tag of these is humongous. And everybody goes, well, what do we get for $100 million? And the answer is usually, well, the same thing you have today, just not on 50-year-old technology. And so then everybody says, like, well, okay, well, then why are we going to go spend this like tens or sometimes, you know, $100 million more to make that change? Well, you know, the Southwest Airlines example earlier this year where they sort of had their computer system go down, and it was precisely that. It was just an old system and shit breaks and it broke and it cost them tens of millions of dollars in, you know, a span of hours because of that.
Yeah.
And I think we're going to see a couple more examples like that where big companies, old companies who got this sort of technology really have big data system failures. And it's going to force the hand of some of the, you know, these companies that have just, hey, we all understand market forces. We all understand this making quarterly returns and stuff. And it's hard to go to the market and say, hey, you know, we're going to eat hundreds of millions of dollars, you know, in costs over the next 3 to 5 years for almost nothing, right? Essentially risk mitigation. Nobody wants to do that. And no CEO wants to go to the board and say like, hey, we're taking this giant chunk of change out of our profits or out of our returns to shareholders or whatever for the next few years. But like, it's going to happen, and it's going to have to happen soon. And so that's one that I really like spectating. I'm like, ooh, like who is this going to happen to? Because it's like, I couldn't tell you there because most companies have this risk out there. Right. So
that is,
it's a scary.
Yeah, that is such a, that's such an interesting thought, but yeah, it's totally true. Like there's so much archaic tech out there. There's people tied into it. And like you said, right now we're just seeing like this rapid change, this rapid advancement of AI. Everyone's got to get like on the newest thing as fast as possible. And maybe by kicking the can down the road for the last 20 years, these people have put themselves in a really bad spot. Like maybe, you know, like you mentioned, of course, Southwest Airlines, the whole system goes down. Of course, they're going to feel the pain from that. But maybe like that's not the only pain people are feeling is a system failure. Maybe the other pain is like, they don't adapt as fast, and like that's the system failure, right? It's like their lack of adapting quick enough, they're gonna get beat by a competitor and like eat market share, lose market share very quickly.
It's like such a tricky question because you know, you can be the first mover, like, hey, there's something new, and then, you know, spend 5 years chasing a technology that dies, like MapR or something like that, right? Like you can build on things that then end up not working out in the long run. And so there's this sort of like weird sweet spot of saying, okay, we're not the first movers, but we're not the laggards. Like, how do you sort of keep pace with that, you know, change of technology? It's a real struggle. It really, really is. And, you know, I think that I'm actually one potential change, which I've started to see in some companies that I actually am curious to see if this continues to accelerate, is sort of IT as an organization moving sort of a little back to like its roots a little bit. You know, it really sort of over the last couple of decades at least, and probably even longer, you know, we've seen IT become much more of a like an organization that just manages software that it buys from other places, and most of that through outsourcing, right? Where companies don't have internal engineering talent anymore in most cases, these bigger companies. And, you know, and maybe I'm biased by the data space where so much of it's built on open source and so much of it, you know, sort of requires that ability to go, you know, to go that direction, is companies are really starting to bring some more of that engineering and talent expertise back in-house. I think sometimes they do so from a slightly misguided perspective. Sometimes they build things that they really should go buy. But
yeah,
that thought that you can't just buy all of your software and be successful as a company, I'm curious to see if that shift continues, because we've seen some more insourcing and some more companies beefing out their internal tech a little bit. And I imagine that trend will continue.
Very, very interesting. One thing that I've heard you mention in the past, you've talked a little bit about how AI is, instead of, you know, it's more of being evolutionary rather than kind of a sudden overhaul. We're talking about the path to AI for companies. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that, and at the same time, talk about some of the common points of failure in AI projects and how those can be avoided.
Yeah. So the evolutionary idea, you know, it's something that I sort of have been mulling over for a while, sort of like watching like what makes a company successful or not successful in the changes, right? And, you know, you hear people sort of talk big pronouncements about like, you know, oh, we're going to like overhaul everything and be more AI driven. And, you know, or you know, now we're an AI first company and stuff. And I think it's usually just words for the street, but
sure. Yeah.
It's interesting to see what does work and what is successful and what does push things out. And it is a change that takes time. You know, every organization is going to have sort of their different pace at which they can move that, but you can't just turn over, you know, and again, even a company at our scale with, you know, 1,200, 1,300 people, like it takes us time to move and change things, let alone big companies with decades of history and, you know, tens of thousands of employees. And so making these changes, you have to make really, like, be really committed to the iterative process that it takes to go into that. And I think that that's one of the things that I've sort of seen where companies, from a strategic perspective, you know, fail the most is they try something, it doesn't work out, and a year later they're, you know, sort of carve off a whole team or sort of start from scratch again. And I think that we're too quick in most cases to sort of just give up on a path and say that didn't work, or the opposite of just put our heads in the sand and keep going. Because we said this is the way that we're going to go, and we're just going to keep going.
Right.
And I remember talking with, you know, someone, you know, a former colleague, where we're having a conversation about sort of like the hiring patterns, right? You know, and I worked there and hired a bunch of people and worked with this person and sort of said, you know, oh, here's how I think about hiring. Look at these different profiles and sort of like, here's how I've sort of adjusted my thinking. Like, how are you guys doing things differently now? You know, it's been like 5 years since we've worked together. And they were just like, oh, I hire the exact same way we always have. And I was sort of like, a little sort of like taken aback, like, okay, that made sense 5 years ago, 6 years ago when we tried it. And it, you know, it didn't work.
Right.
Like, that team is not where you wanted it to be. Part of the reason that I didn't work there anymore. And you sort of say like, okay, like, why are you still doing something the same way? I get why we tried it and it made sense.
Right.
So like, it's weird that you sort of end up with these two, either like companies are like, ah, we gave it 6 months and it doesn't work, throw it away. Or, you know, 5 years later, you're still trying the same thing. And it's like, you have to be willing to try and give something enough time. And I think that that like coming up with, you know, the what is your exit strategy, like when do you say no, but like you have to give it enough time to try it out, but then you have to have a plan for then saying here's when we're going to say nope, this isn't the path and we need to
right
to tweak and to turn into that. And so that like evolutionary idea, like you have to be trying things, you have to be iterating, but it's a slow process. It's a process of years, it's not a process of months. And so watching that sort of play out in different companies, I think, has been really interesting to see some of those things that work and some of those that don't. But that like embracing that sometimes this will work and sometimes it's going to fail. And like, how are we going to decide if it's working or if it's failing? And then if it's not working, what's the decision process for iterating on that? I think far too often we just sort of make a plan that's, you know, good for 3 or 5 years, and either we stick to it all the way through, or if it doesn't work, we just say that it didn't work and we just sort of go away completely, rather than having a process for like iteratively working on and changing and then updating how we're approaching it.
Yeah, I think that's such an important part of creating, like, you know, it's the fine line between having innovation, but also you move too early and, you know, you have those kind of issues. So, so many different interesting things. Connor, thank you so much for sharing your insights with us today. It's been amazing having you on the podcast. If people want to get in contact with you or find out about some of the things you guys are working on at DataIQ, what's the best way for them to, you know, contact you or learn more?
So I'd easy to find on LinkedIn is probably the easiest way to just get a hold of me, you know, Connor Jensen, DataIQ on LinkedIn. You can go to our website, www.dataiku.com. There's about a million different pronunciations out there, but you know, that's the place to find us.
I've been hoping I did it right, but okay.
There's more, as a global company, there's a lot of variations. There's a lot of right answers, I guess. So the website, you know, hit me up on LinkedIn if you'd like to dig in more. You know, at the website, we've got a lot of our sort of like where we've focused in different industries or, you know, different technologies looking at like generative AI or pieces like that. So, you know, please feel free to reach out, you know, always happy to go deeper on these topics. And thanks for having me because I really enjoyed the conversation, Jaden.
Thanks so much, Connor. And to the listener, thanks so much for tuning in to the AI Chat podcast. Make sure to rate us wherever you get your podcasts and have an amazing rest of your
day. If you are looking for an innovative and creative community of people using ChatGPT, you need to join our ChatGPT creators community. I'll drop a link in the description to this podcast. We'd love to see you there where we share tips and tricks of what is working in ChatGPT. It's a lot easier than a podcast as you can see screenshots, you can share and comment on things that are currently working. So if this sounds interesting to you, check out the link in the comment. We'd love to have you in the community.
Thanks for tuning in to the AI Hustle podcast. If you could do us a massive favor, we would really, really appreciate it if you could leave us a review wherever you get your podcasts. This helps people find the podcast. It helps people know this is a good place to go. And we would really, really appreciate it as it helps us continue to bring on incredible guests and share incredible content for you to listen to. Welcome to the Open AI podcast, the podcast that opens up the world of AI in a quick and concise manner. Tune in daily to hear the latest news and breakthroughs in the rapidly evolving world of artificial intelligence.
Why choose a Sleep Number smart bed?
Can I make my site softer?
Can I make my site firmer?
Can we sleep cooler?
Sleep Number does that. Cools up to 8 times faster and lets you choose your ideal comfort on either side. Your Sleep Number setting. JD Power ranks Sleep Number number 1 in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store and online. And now the more you buy, the more you save on beds, faces, and more. Limited time. For JD Power 2025 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Check it out at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com today.